From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last week, the United Nations chose the man who'll be its next Secretary General, but you may not have noticed because that story was overshadowed by North Korea's nuclear test. On today's backstory segment, we look at Ban Ki-moon, the South Korean foreign minister who, starting this coming January, will be leading the UN. And joining me now is Diana Geddes, the legal affairs editor of The Economist. I'm very pleased to welcome her to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Since he's the South Korean foreign minister, was Ban Ki-moon involved in the six-party talks with North Korea?
He would indeed have been involved. He had said all along that he's had some kind of experience in dealing with the North Korean nuclear crisis and that this should be useful.
And, well, under the circumstances, I assume that some of this will be resolved by the time he actually takes office in January, but right now there were reports that North Korea is planning a second nuclear test, and the North Koreans have called the UN sanctions a declaration of war, according to CNN.
Indeed, it's quite a frightening prospect, and I don't know how the UN is going to manage to deal with this. The Security Council is the one that has to call the shots. And as we know, some of the permanent members are not keen on imposing too aggressive sanctions on North Korea. And I don't suppose South Korea would be willing to go along with anything that undermined its ultimate goal of reunifying the Korean Peninsula.
So would South Korea's unwillingness to confront the North work against Ban as Secretary General?
I don't think so. He's got the experience of dealing with the North. And what one must remember is the... I'm sorry, could I just say that we've got a bad echo on the line and that I'm finding it very difficult to talk to with you?
Well, then maybe we should just take a moment and hang up. And no, we can't do that. We're on ISDN, which is a very good connection. Maybe somebody there can fix it for you, I hope.
That sounds better already.
Okay,
great. The problem's been solved. I'm sorry about
that. Okay,
well,
you see that? So you move the mic, and the next thing you know, I assume that's what happened. That's what sounded like was happening. Ban has worked in many diplomatic posts over his 36-year career. Has he been an effective diplomat for South Korea?
He seems to have been. South Korea has done extremely well since it was, as it were, created a few years after the war. It is now, it's risen from one of the world's poorest countries to being its 11th wealthiest country, which is a staggering development over so short a period. As a foreign minister and previous civil servant, he obviously didn't have so much to do with that. But yes, South Korea is a strong supporter of the US, and the US, as a result, is a strong supporter of South Korea too. And at the moment, they have managed to keep some kind of relationship going with the North, however tenuous and fragile that relationship is. I do see that as being one of the problems for Mr. Ban. But what I was going to say before, I'm sorry I interrupted the program, was that what one has to remember is that the UN Secretary General can only do so much. He is not a chief executive officer. He's not even really the world's chief diplomat insofar as he has, that is not part of his job title. He sometimes acts as such, but he is merely, according to the UN Charter, the chief administrative officer of the UN Secretariat, and as such he is the servant and not the master of the UN, and the UN in that sense means the Security Council, the decision-making body on all security matters, and beyond that, the permanent five, the five countries with the right of veto. And he can only, as Kofi Annan himself, the present Secretary General, has found, he can only do so much. The Security Council has to make the decisions.
Well, when he was a candidate for Secretary General, Mr. Ban stressed promising less and delivering more. Can that be read as a critique of Kofi Annan's tenure?
Certainly, and I think a lot of what he's been saying can be read as a critique. He's talked about needing to see the United Nations reborn as a viable and efficient organisation. Well, what is it now? Maybe that's necessary. Maybe it's necessary to get people to believe that the UN can change quickly and effectively. But over his 10 years as Secretary General, Kofi Annan has struggled and struggled to get reform through. And it is not his fault if the reforms that he suggested have not gone through. Time and again, he's been blocked either by the US on some occasions, and on other occasions by the so-called G77 group of developing countries. But it is not an easy role to be Secretary General, and he may say he's going to go soft on the promises and see if he can achieve more, but it's an extremely difficult organisation to change, as has been shown over the last 60 years of its life, and it's not through want of trying.
Is he suggesting that he may not continue the reforms of the UN that Kofi Annan tried to instigate?
Oh, no, not at all. I'm sorry if I suggested that. No, on the contrary.
You didn't suggest it. I was just wondering about it.
No, on the contrary, I think he definitely will try and push through the reforms, especially the reforms of the Secretariat. And, of course, he'll be bringing in his own top team into the Secretariat as well.
Well, Kofi Annan was rather unpopular in some parts of the UN because he pushed so hard. He was rather forceful. And some of these reforms are problematical, aren't they? For example, enlarging the Security Council.
Indeed. But why are they problematical? It's because, again, the various members of mainly the permanent members of the Security Council don't want particular members to come on. I mean, in that respect, Mr. Ban might also have difficulty, for example, with allowing Japan to become a permanent member. Now, Japan is the only country that at the moment America is backing as a candidate for a permanent seat. There are others, of course, that would like to be, but Japan is the only one that has the approval of the United States.
Germany and India.
Not Germany and India don't have the United States approval at the moment. Now, Germany fell out of favor with the United States over its opposition to the Iraq war under Councillor Schroeder. Now that Germany has a new councillor or head of state, namely Angela Merkel, that could change. She has shown all along that she is much more supportive of America in all kinds of ways, and we've yet to get America to pronounce again on whether it would like Germany to become a permanent member. But just going back to Mr. Ban has always, or South Korea, has always objected to giving a permanent membership to Japan, which is the former colonial ruler of Korea. And many Koreans suspect that Japan is still hostile to Korea and any kind of designs it might have for increasing its role in the world. So there will be some things like that will be difficult for Mr. Ban, perhaps personally, though one has to remember that the Secretary General is no longer a representative of his country. He is, as I said before, the chief servant of the United Nations and is that, as such, supposedly without a nationality.
And I'm sure that those things were discussed with the United States before the U.S. threw its support behind Mr. Ban.
I'm absolutely sure they were, and a lot of other things besides.
My guest is Diana Geddes, the legal affairs editor of The Economist. We're talking about the Secretary General-elect of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, a man who most Americans know very little about. And they know a lot about Kofi Annan, and that's perhaps because he was a really strong character. But it's interesting, Boutros-Ghali fell out of favor with the United States, then Kofi Annan fell out of favor with the United States. Is this a job that almost has that as a natural consequence?
I think it does. The United States is the world's superpower or hyperpower, as Hubert Védrine, the former French foreign minister, described it. It's used to getting its own way. It's got the greatest army, it's got the greatest economic might, it's got the loudest diplomatic voice as a result. And the UN, insofar as it represents a collective attitude or will of the world's now 192 member states of the UN, is seen, and rightly so, as a constraint on the U.S.'s desire and ability to act unilaterally. Why should a country that has so much power act unilaterally? Now, that is the job of the UN and of the UN Secretary General, to show and convince the U.S. that in some areas it's still necessary and in its own interests to act collectively. On things like global warming, on the spread of AIDS and other diseases, even on things like the aid to developing countries, so as to bring them out of a situation where they might be, or failing states, where they might be a source of international terrorism.
How do you think this is playing out in the balloting for the Latin American seat on the Security Council, which is going on today?
It's very interesting.
Guatemala's leading Venezuela, but hasn't reached the two-thirds majority they need.
Absolutely. I can't remember how many rounds we're already at, but it's over a dozen. This is very interesting. It's also interesting to see to what extent the support for Venezuela, which is often neck and neck with Guatemala, sometimes it falls a bit behind, how that support is fluctuating. I mean, if a country is voting for Venezuela, why does it then decide not to vote on the fifth round, but then decides to vote again on the seventh round? So I'm not quite sure what's going on, except, as you quite rightly suggest, and this is Venezuela under Hugo Chavez, is one of America's great bete noires. Chavez called in his speech at the United Nations General Assembly last month, he described President Bush as the devil and said he could smell sulfur, so the devil must have been there before him. I mean, the America does not want Venezuela, even as a non-permanent member, which is what it's up for, on the Security Council. It thinks it would cause trouble, and I think it's quite right to think that.
Well, in the light of that devil statement, right now we're in the 12th round. I think it's going to be resolved in the 13th round. But has Mr. Ban ever worked for South Korea's mission to the UN? Because I know the presidency of the General Assembly fell to South Korea, coincidentally, by the way, in the midst of another crisis on September 12th. 2001.
I don't know enough of Mr. Ban's career to be able to tell you whether he's worked for the South Korean embassy to the UN in New York. I think not. He certainly was in Washington. I'm don't think that he has ever worked in New York at the UN, but I could be wrong on that.
As a candidate, Mr. Ban talked a lot about not overextending the UN and following through on the commitments that the UN makes. Will that improve the image of the UN? Is that one of the reasons people decided to throw their support to him?
Ah, goodness knows. And what did he mean by that? You know, on the one hand...
Well, there is a sense that the UN is all over the place and even
yes.
and overextended, but at the same time, totally impotent in most of the places that it has a presence.
Well, wait one moment on that. I mean, are we referring to overstretching in its peacekeeping and peace-enforcing capacities? It said itself that it's can't get enough troops yet for the number of areas and missions that it's got in the world. That is one form of overstretching that can be remedied simply by member states proposing more troops and by coughing up more money. But does he mean that the UN is overstretched insofar as it's perhaps intervening or trying to intervene too much in order to prevent human rights abuses and atrocities around the world? If he meant that, I would be extremely sad, and I think a lot of other people would be. I mean, we've got the situation at the moment in Darfur that America has described as a genocide. I mean, that's a question of definition of what is a genocide. Other people think it's ethnic cleansing, but whatever's happening, a lot of people are getting killed, a lot of people are being terrorized, a lot of people are getting mutilated and starved to death through the activities of both the rebel militias and the government-backed militias, and indeed the government forces themselves. For 2 years, the Security Council has been debating this and arguing about what they should do. They can't agree to do anything, despite the fact that in the World Summit outcome document of September 2005, all the world's leaders signed up to a new, wonderful responsibility to protect the victims of such atrocities, where the country in which the atrocities were occurring was unable or unwilling to act. The Darfur is an absolutely classic example of where the responsibility to protect should be working, but the Security Council can't agree.
Another example is the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah this summer.
Absolutely.
The UN couldn't intervene. And we saw similar things in the past. Rwanda, for example, where the UN couldn't intervene because some of its members didn't want that.
And who was mainly responsible for that? And the United States again. The United States has had its fingers burnt in Somalia in a peacekeeping mission that it was involved in there. Actually, it was more to do with distributing humanitarian relief.
I thought the French played a role in Rwanda, but...
The French, if you'll excuse my saying so, I think I'm right in saying, because I was actually the Economist correspondent in France at the time and took a special interest in France's attitude. The French were the first to send in their own troops before there was even a vote on whether the UN was going to resend in its troops. If you remember, it pulled out a lot of its troops just as the beginning of the massacre, the genocide, was occurring. And it was an appalling event. One may add also that Rwanda itself was a member of the Security Council at that time and wasn't at all keen for people to intervene in its state. So that also operated. But certainly the United States was one of the main countries that wasn't keen to go dashing back into an area of Africa where it thought it and other members of the United Nations were going to get bogged down again.
My guess
and
is
humiliated.
Diana Geddes, the legal affairs editor at The Economist, we're talking about the Secretary General elect of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon. 10 days ago, The Guardian reported that some senior officials at the UN were upset by Ban's selection. What are some of their reservations about him?
I think that it's what a lot of people have been saying is two things. One, which is precisely, incidentally, what people said about Kofi Annan when he was appointed, is he Washington's man? Is he simply going to do Washington's bidding? The second reservation that people have is he going to be tough enough for this job? People keep commenting on the fact that he's got lots of charm and a lovely smile, but what is behind that? He says, well, you know, wait and see. In Asia, we tend to operate in a low-key way, but we've got an inner strength inside. And so to a certain extent, one does have to wait and see. Kofi Annan was absolutely not a puppet of Washington in any way at all, as the massive criticism of him in his second term in office demonstrated. Kofi had one enormous strength in that in his first term in office, he became so lauded around the world, and this is what's often forgotten, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001. A lot of his staff regarded him as a kind of secular pope. He was idolized. And then suddenly, and I think this was what made matters so difficult for him, that after having been thrust up onto the sort of heights of idolization in the world, and much approved of by Washington as well, he was suddenly brought so low, in a way, initially, through no fault of his own, through the Security Council's opposition to the Iraq war, and then by the oil for food scandal, though one could say that he failed insofar as he hadn't kept a close enough watch on that. But again, as the Volcker report made clear, it wasn't just the Secretariat's responsibility, it was indeed the Security Council's decision to set up this program, which in the end did a lot of good. It was also, in the first instance, the Security Council's responsibility to keep an oversight of that program. And they failed as much as the Secretariat failed.
Is it surprising that both China and the United States have come to support Ban, and Britain and France reluctantly going along later?
I don't know of all what's been said and done behind the scenes.
Well, it's been reported that the United States is worried Ban is too close to China.
Yes.
And everyone
yes.
else seems to be worried that he's too close to the United States.
I know. That's what I'm meaning, is that South Korea were lobbying. I mean, this is also strange that it's kind of not done to lobby for a candidate for general secretary. But South Korea have been openly lobbying for Ban Ki-moon for the last 2 years, to such an extent that people have even been talking about bribes being paid to third world countries to vote for him. South Korea replies that's absolute nonsense. This was all part of their aid package anyway. It's interesting, and one will not be able to tell, as I say, until Ban Ki-moon is in his job. So many times people that have looked as if they might be a pushover before they came to a job, whether it's president of a country or head of a organization like the UN, have changed once they are actually in situ themselves. But
well, one UN official was quoted by Time magazine as saying that to actually be chosen for the job, the candidate must be a person who offends no one, which obviously is impossible.
Absolutely.
But this man must have some paper trail.
He doesn't seem to, you know. That's one of the things that people object to about him. He seems to be a technocrat, a totally competent technocrat. That's the image that the world has of him at the moment. We don't know enough about him.
And he's from Asia. And that's important because the last two secretary generals have been from Africa, Kofi Annan, from Ghana, Boutros Ghali, from Egypt. And the last Asian secretary general was U Thant, one who I think most people remember with certain fondness, don't they?
Yes, but I don't think he was ever considered a great secretary general. And he, oddly enough, at this moment when Annan is going out, I would say it's under still a bit of a cloud. I still think the UN is fighting for its survival. The reforms that have been pushed through have either been pale shadows of themselves or what Annan originally wanted them to be, or have proved useless already, like, as I say, the responsibility to protect. That may not be useless in the long term, but at the moment it's done absolutely nothing to prevent atrocities. Or the new Human Rights Council, which looks as rotten as its predecessor was. And it is such a shame. The Peace Building Commission, which was the other great reform, has yet to show if it can do anything. I'm quite despondent about the future of the UN. But Kofi, who has come under such criticism, will probably go down in history as being the most reformist and probably popular, in certainly in his first term, and even effective Secretary General, other than Dag Hammarskjöld. Uthant was popular, you're certainly right, and people were fond of him, but I don't think that he necessarily achieved very much with and for the UN. And one must remember in saying that was a time during the Cold War when the UN was anyway almost totally paralysed by the great division between the Soviet Union on the one hand and the US on the other. I mean, almost everything that the US did during that period was outside the remit of the UN. Its interventions in Latin, military interventions, as well as sort of secretive CIA interventions in Latin America and Africa, they were all done without UN approval and therefore technically were illegal under international law.
I'm glad you've ended this on such cheerful notes. My thanks to Diana Geddes, the legal affairs editor at The Economist. We've been talking about Ban Ki-moon, the next Secretary General of the United Nations, as part of our backstory series. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.